All stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Mountain State Survival covers your basis for your planning, prepping, evacuation, bugging in, or bugging out needs. They carry anything from educational material, camping supplies, emergency services supplies, food, first aid, survival kit and equipment, shooting gear, survival gear, tactical gear. They carry it all. They got it in stock. Give Mountain State Survival a ring. That's mountain-state-survival.com. Get this type of supplies while you still can. 304-517-6935. Mountain State Survival is one of the only places that I know of currently that is still carrying the delicious Peak Refuel meal that is ready to eat. It's personally the only thing that I eat at this point whenever I go out camping, whenever we have any type of emergency or disaster situation. That is the meal that I stick with, and you can find that at mountain-state-survival.com. Use Wrecker5 for a 5% discount on your overall purchase. That's Wrecker5, mountain-state-survival.com. For the Fallen by Lawrence Binion. With proud thanksgiving, a mother for her children, England mourns for her dead across the sea. Flesh of her flesh they were, spirit of her spirit, fallen in the cause of the free. Solemn the drums thrill, death august and royal, sings sorrow up into immortal spheres. There is music in the midst of desolation, and a glory that shines upon our tears. They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall grow not old, as we are left to grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. They mingle not with their laughing comrades again. They sit no more at familiar tables of home. They have no lot in our labor of the daytime. They sleep beyond England's foam. But where our desires are, and our hopes profound, felt as a wellspring that is hidden from sight, to the innermost heart of their own land they are known, as the stars are known to the night. And the stars that shall be bright when we are dust, moving in marches upon the heavenly plain, as the stars that are starry in the time of our darkness, to the end, they remain. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the American Vindicta Show. Numerous amounts of times I have talked about war. I have talked about the inner workings of war, the mass casualties, the mass tragedies. I have talked to you about the numbers, about the movements, about the origins of war. I've talked to you about the Revolution. I've talked to you about World War II, wars that have been happening now. One of the things I'd like to go over is World War I and the trench warfare. Not many people can relate, but I think the surviving veterans that we have in our country and those historians who pay attention can somewhat relate to what it meant to be down amongst the dead men.
For those of you who do not know, trench warfare is a type of land-based warfare that is used when competing armies are occupying lines that largely comprise of military trenches in which the troops are well protected from the enemy's fire. These fires are typically small arms fire, machine gun fire, heavy machine gun fire, anywhere from then to gas-propelled grenades like mortars, rocket attacks, tank barrages, artillery attacks. One of the most common fatal parts of trench warfare is not so much the actual fighting, but it is surviving the trench. Some of the biggest casualties of World War I actually came from the trenches where the fighting was not. It came from the sickness and those dying and the men that were shell-shocked. In fact, if you didn't know this, trench warfare remains arguably the most effective strategy for infantry. For whatever reason, armor and air support are not exactly lacking, but so technologically advanced that at times they are actually incapable of carrying out warfare in the manner of an infantry invasion. With all the talks of war that is happening lately, we need to consider the fact that America may be in a world war soon. We know that America is not ready for a world war. Economically, we're not ready. I would have to say spiritually, we're definitely not ready. Financially, America has given most of our GDP to other countries to fight our war for us. And it's arguably one of the biggest benefactors of the next world war will be the minglings of the American government into other nations and their matters. Currently, with all the things happening across Europe, we forget that there are other nations that are still at war amongst themselves with terror organizations like the Middle East and Africa and South America. America is at war with itself. And it's hard to consider that we now have boots on the ground in Ukraine with our own U.S. military as either roles of advisors or as what they are calling inspectors, which I can only guess they are inspecting chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear material. Who really knows the end game on that one? But I think we are throwing our men in the fray, knowing that eventually one of them will get at least a shrapnel rune from some sort of artillery attack or rocket-propelled attack. We know that if we continue to push our guys closer to the war front, someone will get killed or injured, and I believe our politicians will capitalize on it. Nobody speaks about the draft, but I will. Be prepared for the draft. Our military, within the ranking standards of the world, has been downgraded for the first time. That's not good. And I think that will be one of the excuses for why the draft will happen. I believe World War III will potentially happen in 2024 to 2028. I give that four-year time frame because in my mind, it seems that our politicians, the elite of our country, need to ensure that America is going through a deep recession. We are going through an economical revolt right now with this whole Green New Deal. Even though we could be making money right now and still be the wealthiest nation in the world if we would just start drilling our own oil, pumping our own gas. We could be sending liquid natural gas to the entire world, but we decide not to. We could at least be refilling our own stockpiles instead of having to buy from a third-party source of Russia. But instead, we are deflating the dollar. We are going to inflate the entire currency to the point that it means nothing anymore. The Federal Reserve chairman has came out and said that they are soon to move to more or less destabilize the economy in order to save the economy, knowing that it will cost millions of jobs. This has already happened due to the pandemic. We still have not recovered from the job losses, and now we are prepared to do this again. If you look back into the throes of history, ladies and gentlemen, you are going to see the markers of what makes a world war, and it is always economical. It's resource-led. So we are going for other resources for other nations. I think that's one of the main reasons why we want to try and get Ukraine inside the parameters of NATO, so that we can then tap the resources of Ukraine. I think we're trying to starve out Vladimir Putin. And I think Vladimir Putin, honestly, is doing a fairly good job of depleting the United States' financial resources and also our military resources. And let me tell you why, and why I think these things will eventually come back home. As we send our stockpiles of oil and our stockpiles of munitions to Ukraine, Vladimir Putin is throwing antiquated military equipment. Yeah, it still costs a lot of money, but it's not his latest and greatest. But we are throwing antiquated he's throwing antiquated military equipment into the various different phase lines of their push from east to west into Ukraine. And what it seems to me that he is doing is he is using equipment that he feels, I guess, to some extent, is all right with losing because it's not the most high tech that he has. And with every tank lost and with every missile fired from the Ukrainians that's being sent by their allies, it will eventually be one less missile used in about 2 to 3 years from now, when Vladimir Putin finally makes the big push into Ukraine. I think this conflict is going to last for another year. I think it's going to be slow. It's going to be grueling. It's going to be a very, how do I say this, quasi-Iraq-style fighting, where it's almost like if his military forces are going to go foot by foot across this country and draw as many fighters as possible with the lowest amount of civilian casualties that he can incur and accept the military casualties in order to draw out all the fighters and all the equipment, all the ordnance, every cachet, until eventually he can walk his forces right into Kiev without a battle. That is kind of what I'm expecting. And because of this, you have to understand that Russia, like China, plays the long game. They play the long war. They will draw this war out until eventually Ukraine breaks our budget. And after Ukraine is failed, Europe is next. Europe will eventually not have any choice but to capitulate to Vladimir Putin's westward expansion of his empire. As we all know, Vladimir Putin considers him Peter the Great? And he wants to rebuild or reimagine the Soviet Empire as it was pre-Cold War. He wants to gain back all the countries that they lost. And I think he wants to be back on top of the world economic stage before his death. If I'm correct, then that means probably before Vladimir Putin is 80, and by that point in time incapable of running the country, he wants to have their land back, and that is his legacy. That's what he wants to leave behind. And who knows for how long the oligarchs will back him. I think that's one of the reasons why the world intelligence agencies are trying to stir up strife along with the media, trying to paint a picture of Vladimir Putin and a failing economy, a failing country, losing the war in Ukraine. I don't see that. I don't see him losing the war in Ukraine. I don't see him having a failing economy. He just detached himself from the rest of the world's economy. And now, oh, by the way, if you want oil and liquid natural gas, you got to buy it in ruble. So in some ways, he's winning this game. And we, I think, as Americans, or at least our American government, are foolishly playing with the nuclear bear. We have pushed the bear into a corner with the expansion of NATO. And with the fact that now, besides Ukraine, NATO is almost on every border of Russia. The bear is being forced out of the cave. And we need to remember that the bear has nuclear claws. And we don't know just exactly how well our Patriot defense system will take down intercontinental ballistic missiles, let alone hypersonic missiles. And so because of what I'm saying, because of the seriousness of war, I want you to consider just what exactly do we benefit in our own country right now with our midterm elections coming up, with the complete split of our government or of our people. If we are going to go into world war, why would we go into world war as a shattered, divided country? It doesn't make sense. You would think, obviously, that we would want to come together as a nation to combat the boogeyman of Russia and China, which is funny because we pay for all this to be happening right now. We still pay for Russia's oil. We still buy it from them. We still buy their liquid natural gas. We still buy many resources from Russia. We still allow Russia on the national scale to be moving their goods and produce around the world. And so does China. And we allow China to spy on us. We allow China to turn our own politicians against us through bribery. We allow China to sell us defective equipment. We allow China to sell us electronic equipment that we know they have a backdoor into. We allow China to now buy tens of thousands of acres of farmland or just raw land in America to harvest the resources, to set up solar farms, and also to establish a military presence, albeit you got to understand that this is all planned. If you can't accept that it's not planned, then what and how do we explain this? With what measurement do we explain the complacency of our generals and of our congressmen, senators, and our executive staff? At what point do we say generals are dumb? That these men, most with doctorates, that these men who are professors at war colleges, 30 years of tactics, of technology, of strategery, isn't that what George Bush said? Strategery. There's another good idiot. With all the talks of war, why has not one person from the Pentagon came out and said, Mr. President, we cannot go to war if we have no ammunition to go to war with, because we're sending our ordnances, our missiles, our rocket launchers. We're sending our heavy machine guns, medium machine guns, light armaments, light weaponry like our M4s, pistols, and the ammunition for all these weapon systems. If we don't have that to defend ourselves, because you have to understand that if America is ever invaded, we will have a draft. You will have militias. National Guard will no longer be the reservist army. It will be a standing army. If we get invaded, sheriff's departments will become militarized. Police departments will become militarized. People will be forced into this conflict, whether you're a pacifist or not. So, with all that now being put onto the floor, explain to me why President Biden has recently said this most, one of the most divisive things I've ever heard, and I worked for the government for 15 years, and I've heard quite a bit, especially through the Obama era. Listen to this.
Good evening. Thank you. Please, thank you. Good evening, everyone. Just a few days ago, a little before 2:30 a.m. in the morning, a man smashed the back windows and broke into the home of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the third highest ranking official in America. He carried in his backpack zip ties, duct tape, rope, and a hammer. As he told the police, he had come looking for Nancy Pelosi to take her hostage, to interrogate her, to threaten to break her kneecaps. But she wasn't there. Her husband, my friend Paul Pelosi, was home alone. The assailant tried to take Paul hostage. He woke him up. He wanted to tie him up. The assailant ended up using a hammer to smash Paul's skull. Thankfully, by the grace of God, Paul survived. All this happened after the assault. And it just, it's hard to even say. After the assailant entered the home asking, where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol on January the 6th, when they broke windows, kicked in the doors, brutally attacked law enforcement, roamed the corridors hunting for officials, and erected gallows to hang the former Vice President, Mike Pence. It was an enraged mob that had been whipped up into a frenzy by a president repeating over and over again the big lie that the election of 2020 had been stolen. It's a lie that fueled the dangerous rise in political violence and voter intimidation over the past 2 years. Even before January the 6th, we saw election officials and election workers in a number of states subject to menacing calls, physical threats, even threats to their very lives. In Georgia, for example, Republican Secretary of State and his family were subjected to death threats because he refused to break the law and give in to the defeated president's demand, just find him 11,780 votes. Just find me 11,780 votes. Election workers like Shay Moss and her mother Ruby Freeman were harassed and threatened just because they had the courage to do their job and stand up for the truth, to stand up for our democracy. This institution, this intimidation, this violence against Democrats, Republicans, and nonpartisan officials just doing their jobs are the consequence of lies told for power and profit, lies of conspiracy and malice, lies repeated over and over to generate a cycle of anger, hate, vitriol, and even violence. In this moment, we have to confront those lies with the truth. The very future of our nation depends on it. My fellow Americans, we're facing a defining moment, an inflection point. We must, with one overwhelming, unified voice, speak as a country and say there's no place for voter intimidation or political violence in America, whether it's directed at Democrats or Republicans. No place, period. No place ever. I speak today near Capitol Hill, near the U.S. Capitol, the citadel of our democracy. I know there's a lot at stake in these midterm elections, from our economy to the safety of our streets to our personal freedoms, the future of health care, Social Security, Medicare. It's all important. But we'll have our differences. We'll have our difference of opinion. And that's what it's supposed to be. But there's something else at stake. Democracy itself. I'm not the only one who sees it. Recent polls have shown that an overwhelming majority of Americans believe our democracy is at risk, that our democracy is under threat. They, too, see that democracy is on the ballot this year, and they're deeply concerned about it. So today, I appeal to all Americans, regardless of party, to meet this moment of national and generational importance. We must vote, knowing what's at stake and not just the policy of the moment, but institutions that have held us together as we sought a more perfect union are also at stake. We must vote knowing who we have been, what we're at risk of becoming. Look, my fellow Americans, the old expression, freedom is not free. It requires constant vigilance. From the very beginning, nothing has been guaranteed about democracy in America. Every generation has had to defend it, protect it, preserve it, choose it. For that's what democracy is. It's a choice, a decision of the people, by the people, and for the people. The issue couldn't be clearer in my view. We, the people, must decide whether we'll have fair and free elections. And every vote counts. We, the people, must decide whether we're going to sustain a republic where reality is accepted, the law is obeyed, and your vote is truly sacred. We, the people, must decide whether the rule of law will prevail, whether we'll allow the dark forces to thirst for power, put ahead of the principles that we've long guided us. You know, American democracy is under attack because the defeated former president of the United States refuses to accept the results of the 2020 election. He refuses to accept the will of the people. He refuses to accept the fact that he lost. He has abused his power and put the loyalty to himself before loyalty to the Constitution. And he's made a big lie, an article of faith in the MAGA Republican Party, the minority of that party. The great irony about the 2020 election is that it's the most attacked election in our history. And yet, there's no election in our history that we can be more certain of its results. Every legal challenge that could have been brought was brought. Every recount that could have been undertaken was undertaken. Every recount confirmed the results. Wherever fact or evidence had been demanded, the big lie has been proven to be just that, a big lie, every single time. Yet now, extreme MAGA Republicans aim to question not only the legitimacy of past elections, but elections being held now and into the future. The extreme MAGA element of the Republican Party, which is a minority of that party, as I said earlier, but it's this driving force, is trying to succeed where they failed in 2020, to suppress the right of voters and subvert the electoral system itself. That means denying your right to vote and deciding whether your vote even counts. Instead of waiting until an election is over, they're starting well before it. They're starting now. They've emboldened violence and intimidation of voters and election officials. It's estimated that there are more than 300 election deniers on the ballot all across America this year. We can't ignore the impact this is having on our country. It's damaging, it's corrosive, and it's destructive. And I want to be very clear, this is not about me. It's about all of us. It's about what makes America, America. It's about the durability of our democracy. For democracies are more than a form of government. They're a way of being, a way of seeing the world, a way that defines who we are, what we believe, why we do what we do. Democracy is simply that fundamental. We must, in this moment, dig deep within ourselves and recognize that we can't take democracy for granted any longer. With democracy on the ballot, we have to remember these first principles. Democracy means the rule of the people, not the rule of monarchs or the moneyed, but the rule of the people. Autocracy is the opposite of democracy. It means the rule of one, one person, one interest, one ideology, one party. To state the obvious, the lives of billions of people from antiquity till now have been shaped by the battle between these competing forces, between the aspirations of the many and the greed and power of the few, between the people's right for self-determination and the self-seeking autocrat, between the dreams of a democracy and the appetites of an autocracy. What we're doing now is going to determine whether democracy will long endure. It, in my view, is the biggest of questions. Whether the American system that prizes the individual, bends towards justice, and depends on the rule of law, whether that system will prevail. This is the struggle we're now in, a struggle for democracy, a struggle for decency and dignity, a struggle for prosperity and progress, a struggle for the very soul of America itself. Make no mistake, democracy is in the ballot for all of us. We must remember that democracy is a covenant. We need to start looking out for each other again, seeing ourselves as we the people, not as entrenched enemies. This is a choice we can make. Disunion and chaos are not inevitable. There's been anger before in America. There's been division before in America. But we've never given up on the American experiment. We can't do that now. The remarkable thing about American democracy is this. Just enough of us, on just enough occasions, have chosen not to dismantle democracy, but to preserve democracy. We must choose that path again. Because democracy is in the ballot, we have to remember that even in our darkest moments, there are fundamental values and beliefs that unite us as Americans, and they must unite us now. What are they? Well, I think first, we believe the vote in America is sacred, to be honored, not denied, respected, not dismissed, counted, not ignored. A vote is not a partisan tool to be counted when it helps your candidates and tossed aside when it doesn't. Second, we must, with an overwhelming voice, stand against political violence and voter intimidation, period. Stand up and speak against it. We don't settle our differences in America with a riot, a mob, or a bullet, or a hammer. We settle them peaceably at the ballot box. We have to be honest with ourselves, though. We have to face this problem. We can't turn away from it. We can't pretend it's just going to solve itself. There's an alarming rise in the number of our people in this country condoning political violence or simply remaining silent because silence is complicity. The disturbing rise of voter intimidation, the pernicious tendency to excuse political violence, or at least trying to explain it away. We can't allow this sentiment to grow. We must confront it head on now. It has to stop now. I believe the voices excusing or calling for violence and intimidation are a distinct minority in America. But they're loud and they are determined. We have to be more determined. All of us who reject political violence and voter intimidation, and I believe that's the overwhelming majority of the American people, all of us must unite to make it absolutely clear that violence and intimidation have no place in America. And third, we believe in democracy. That's who we are as Americans. I know it isn't easy. Democracy isn't perfect. It always has been. But we're all called to defend it now. Now. History and common sense tell us that liberty, opportunity, and justice thrive in a democracy, not in an autocracy. At our best, America is not a zero-sum society. Or for you to succeed, someone else has to fail. I promise America is big enough. It's big enough for everyone to succeed. Every generation opening the door of opportunity just a little bit wider. Every generation, including those who've been excluded before. We believe we should leave no one behind because each one of us is a child of God. And every person is sacred. If that's true, then every person's rights must be sacred as well. Individual dignity, individual worth, individual determination, that's America. That's democracy. And that's what we have to defend. Look, even as I speak here tonight, 27 million people have already cast their ballot in the midterm elections. Millions more will cast their ballots in the final days leading up to November the 9th, 8th, excuse me. And for the first time, this is the first time since the national election of 2020, once again, we're seeing record turnout all over the country. And that's good. We want Americans to vote. We want every American's voice to be heard. Now we have to move the process forward. We know that more and more ballots are cast in early voting or by mail in America. We know that many states don't start counting those ballots till after the polls close on November 8th. That means in some cases we won't know the winner of the election for a few days until after, a few days after the election. It takes time to count all legitimate ballots in a legal and orderly manner. It's always been important for citizens in democracy to be informed and engaged. Now it's important for citizens to be patient as well. That's how it's supposed to work. This is also the first election since the events of January 6th, when the armed angry mob stormed the U.S. Capitol. I wish I could say the assault on a democracy had ended that day, but I cannot. As I stand here today, there are candidates running for every level of office in America, for governor, Congress, attorney general, secretary of state, who won't commit, they will not commit to accepting the results of elections that they're running in. This is a path to chaos in America. It's unprecedented. It's unlawful. And it's un-American. I've said before, you can't love your country only when you win. This is no ordinary year. So I ask you to think long and hard about the moment we're in. In a typical year, we're often not faced with questions of whether the vote we cast will preserve democracy or put us at risk. But this year we are. This year, I hope you'll make the future of our democracy an important part of your decision to vote and how you vote. I hope you'll ask a simple question of each candidate you might vote for. Will that person accept the legitimate will of the American people, the people voting in his district or her district? Will that person accept the outcome of the election, win or lose? The answer to that question is vital. And in my opinion, it should be decisive. And the answer to that question hangs the future of the country we love so much and the fate of the democracy that has made so much possible for us. Too many people have sacrificed too much for too many years for us to walk away from the American project and democracy. Because we've enjoyed our freedoms for so long, it's easy to think they'll always be with us no matter what. But that isn't true today. In our bones, we know democracy is at risk. But we also know this. It's within our power, each and every one of us, to preserve our democracy. And I believe we will. I think I know this country. I know we will. You have the power. It's your choice. It's your decision. The fate of the nation, the fate of the soul of America, lies where it always does, with the people, in your hands, in your heart, in your ballot. My fellow Americans, we'll meet this moment. We just need to remember who we are. We are the United States of America. There's nothing, nothing beyond our capacity if we do it together. May God bless you all. May God protect our troops. May God bless those standing guard over our democracy. Thank you. Godspeed.
Many of you are probably wondering, Doug, why would you play a 21.5-minute speech from Joe Biden? Because for the sake of pure transparency on my part, I wanted you to hear the entire speech. And I believe this speech is actually a pivotal moment in U.S. politics. We now have a sitting president who has declared everything that his party has done for the previous presidency, the previous election, as illegitimate, violating the law, not accepting the losses that their candidates received. But now, because he's president, it's time to enforce the law. It's time to accept the losses. It's time to accept the wins. It's time to stop rioting. It's time to stop being violent at the ballots. Now that they win, it's okay. Now that they win, they can enforce the law. I do not believe Americans will continue to sit back and watch the degradation of our nation for very much longer. And I think as long as Joe Biden continues to spiral in his health and his mental health, his handlers are going to continue to use him the way they have. And this man is going to be used as a useful idiot to drive us into world war, crash the economy, and so on and so forth. One of the reasons why I played this speech is because this is perhaps one of the most coherent things Joe Biden has said since he's become a president, and that means they either gave him all of his medicines today, or this was done on purpose for today, and everything that was wrote, he did not write that. That was wrote for him, for a reason. It's a declaration of war amongst voters. If you don't vote the Democratic way, you're against democracy. If you vote the Republican way, then you are what? A terrorist? A threat to democracy, as our president stated? For one thing, we're not a democracy. We're a republic. That's why our votes work the way they do. That's why we have checks and balances. The problem is we allowed the politicians to take our republic and turn it into a democracy. Demokratia. Rule by the mob. And that's what we suffer now. We suffer from mob rule. We are at a real precipice now. I know many people don't think that this upcoming election cycle means anything, but it does. I know many of you May or may not vote. That's fine. I don't care. But I know many of you won't vote because you don't think your vote matters anymore. Because they cheated once, they'll cheat again, right? All this is the driving effort for our eventual civil war. All this is the driving effort for the war at home. We're going to start wars abroad. They're going to start wars at home. And eventually someone is going to come out of the victor. And I don't believe it's we the people. I believe the chess table is set up. The moves have been calculated and practiced and rehearsed so that when the conflicts start across the world, America will be leading it, and then we and our allies, not so much nation-state allies, but our allies in the dark, will be moving the pawns and taking down the pieces, and eventually it will lead to our demise. I know that's kind of cryptic. I think we're on the precipice of an all-out war. And while we should be getting ready for an economic collapse, which will cause hunger strikes, which will cause riots, which may cause, potentially cause, food rationing, fuel rationing on a nationwide scale. Joe Biden is busy calling half of America a threat. Even to this day, the things that happen to Paul Pelosi lie under a cloud of mismanaged journalism and also I firmly believe were orchestrated. The mainstream media will tell you one thing. The government will tell you the other. Somewhere in there is the truth. You're just not allowed to know it because it is a narrative that is a driving event. The attack upon Pelosi's husband was an event. The narrative to describe the event is what's being told, and that's why they are spinning it the way that it was a Republican's fault. It was a MAGA voter's fault, even though we know that the assailant was an illegal Canadian who is part of the Green Party, who is an all-out leftist, but yet they will call him what they want to call him. They will not tell you the truth, because if they did, then the narrative escapes them. You notice that the president used the reference of January 6 compared to this election. Be planning, be expecting something on that scale to happen. Probably at a ballot box, a voting poll, who knows. Be expecting something. Don't be surprised when it happens. I originally started this wanting to talk to you about World War I. And I wanted to let Joe Biden run his mouth for the entire 21 and a half minutes for the mere fact that this is one of the many things that you will be able to look back on and say that was a defining moment for the next war of America. When a president officially declared Republicans voting as a threat to democracy. Do not think that this presidency and his legislative branch and judicial branch will not try to outright ban voting for the population that most grossly affects them. That's the Republican and conservative and Christian vote. It's funny, Nazi Germany did the same thing. Man, how I can keep pulling history back into the present, and it still makes sense. What to expect here at home when war finally comes? When the Union Army General William Tecumseh Sherman famously said that war is hell, he was referring to war in general, but
He could have been describing trench warfare, which is a military tactic, as I've told you before, that has been traced all the way back to the Civil War. Trenches, long, deep ditches that have been dug as protective defensive barriers, are most often associated with World War I, and the results of trench warfare in that conflict were hellish. Trenches were common throughout the Western Front. Trench warfare in World War I was employed primarily on the Western Front, an area of northern France and Belgium that saw combat between German troops and Allied forces from France, Great Britain, and also the United States. Although trenches were hardly new to combat, prior to the advent of firearms and artillery, trenches were used as a defensive posture against an infantry attack, such as the moats that would surround castles in medieval times. But they became a very fundamental part of strategy with the influx of modern weaponry and the advancements of weapons in war. So these long, narrow trenches that would be dug into the ground at the front, usually by infantry soldiers who would occupy these trenches for weeks at a time, were designed to protect the troops in World War I from machine gun fire and artillery attack, also from aerial attacks. As the Great War also saw the wide use of chemical warfare and poisonous gas, the trenches were thought to offer some degree of protection against exposure. While significant exposure to militarized chemicals such as mustard gas would result in almost certain death, many of the gases used in World War I were still relatively weak in comparison. Thus, the trenches may have actually afforded some protection by allowing soldiers more time to take other defensive steps, such as putting on gas masks, what we call donning your gas mask. At least initially in World War I, forces that mounted attacks from the trenches with bayonets fixed to their rifles would climb over the top of the edge into what is known as no man's land, the area between opposing forces, usually in a single straight line and under a barrage of heavy gunfire. Not surprisingly, this approach was rarely effective and often led to mass casualties. Later on in the war, our forces would begin mounting attacks from the trenches at night, usually with support of covering artillery fire. The Germans soon became known for effectively mounting nighttime incursions behind enemy lines by sending highly trained soldiers to attack the trenches of opposing forces at what they perceived are the weak points. If successful, these soldiers would breach enemy lines and circle around to attack their opponents from the rear, while their comrades would mount a traditional offensive push to the front of the line. The brutality of trench warfare is perhaps mostly known by the 1916 Battle of the Somme in France. British troops lost 60,000 on the first day of fighting alone. 60,000. Disease and shell shock were very rampant in the trenches, with soldiers fighting in close proximity to the trenches, usually in unsanitary conditions. Infectious diseases such as dysentery, cholera, and typhoid were the most common and spread very rapidly. Constant exposure to the wetness caused trench foot, or the immersion of the skin, which at one point in time, this very painful condition would deaden the tissue and would spread across one or both feet, sometimes requiring the amputation of the foot. Trench mouth, also a type of gum infection, was another problematic infection and is thought to be associated with the stress of nonstop bombardments. As they were often effectively trapped in the trenches for long periods of time, under nearly constant bombardment and heavy machine gun fire, many soldiers
would suffer from what is known as shell shock, the debilitating mental illness known today as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. It's likely that all of these factors, which stemmed from the widespread use of trench warfare, made World War I the deadliest conflict in global history to that point. It's believed that as many as 1 in 10 of all fighting forces in the conflicts were killed. So 1 out of every 10 men. It was also the first conflict in world history to have more deaths caused from combat rather than from disease spread during the fighting. For instance, 25% of the death or more from the Revolutionary War were actually caused by plague, by disease during the war, and also starvation. Trench warfare, which was employed in World War II and in the Korean War to some degree, but it has not really been used regularly during conflicts in the ensuing decades, is going to be one of the, let's just go ahead and say, more common themes that America during World War III, Civil War 2.0, are going to be very familiar with again, is trench warfare. Every city will have trenches. You'll have palisades built, bunkers built, building them out of anything that you can. In Iraq, we use simple 2x4s, plywood, and copious amounts of sandbags that we filled ourselves. Then eventually, we got HESCO barriers, which are pretty good. But I don't know how many would be available in the coming years. We talk about stockpiles, not having enough food, not having enough water, available drinking water, not having enough medication or medical staff. We never do really think about how much we're going to need defensive munitions, defensive materials for every town, for every city, for every subdivision, for every home. The manpower that's not going to be there. God forbid we don't have power. And if you don't have batteries to put to be put in your night vision goggles and thermal devices and everything is run off of solar, I mean, you see how these things can be complicated by war. I like to say that all this can be avoided. I think many of this, these situations could be avoided by proper preparation from cities, towns, families, individuals, the government, maybe even. But none of that will matter as long as our politicians continue to not prepare for war. We prepare for war in Ukraine. We prepare for war with Iran in the Middle East. We prepare for war in the Pacific, potentially even first strikes in Russia. But have we prepared for home? With the amount of chaos that is ensuing within our own political dynamics, how many of you honestly think about the invasion of America? Do you think it's capable? Do you think our enemies would stand a chance? With the rate the world is going right now, how many of you actually believe our allies would come to our defense? And are you yourself prepared for war? It's not really a hypothetical anymore. It's a practicality. You need to be prepared for combat. Now, I'm not saying every single man, woman, and child will be involved in that, but if there is war here on the home front, every single man, woman, and child will be involved in it. You'll either be involved in the fighting or the fleeing. You'll either be involved in the dying or the living. So you will be involved.
You will not be spared. The elite will not be spared. The elite will be targeted. The only difference between the targeting of the elite and the populated series, the areas where people will be living, the cities, is that maybe a city will get a blitzkrieg. Maybe a city will get a fuel air bomb. Maybe a city will get a nuke, right? Just to really set the tone of the war. But why would you waste all that and not hit the bunkers where you already know the elite are? We have so many at this point in this country that have aligned themselves with China that are within our political powers, our congressmen, senators, executive staff, judicial, legislative. Somebody has got to tell at some point where the bunkers are. So I don't know how safe the elite think they are, but they're not. And once again, with trench warfare, really one of the most deadliest things that happened was really the chemical munitions. We are so far beyond what was used in World War I that it is truly terrifying, more terrifying than nuclear annihilation, is the plagues that can be set upon mankind by ourselves. Would it be used? If America got into a civil war, do you think Biden would be like Lincoln? Do you think we would have an all-out war? Or do you think we would try to negotiate at some point to avoid numerous amounts of Gettysburgs? It's hard to say when you have a president that has already declared half the country the enemy and not a shot has been fired yet. What happens when the Civil War starts? Because we know the mindset of Joe Biden comes from the mindset of the puppet masters manipulating the strings. So if his handlers believe we are honestly the problem, that we are actually a threat to the Democrats now, and they don't want us to vote now, and they want us to vote for them, they think our votes are illegitimate, whatever. What happens when the war actually starts? To what extent will these people go to protect themselves and their power? That's what I leave you with. That is the level of preparedness I think you should be considering. Do I know how to properly prepare for that? No, I don't think very many of us have the money to afford multi-million dollar bunkers and 10 to 20 years worth of food and water rations, let alone medical supplies, vitamins, the staff you'll need, the fuel you'll need. This survival will be from those who survive in communities. Either communities band together and do it right, or we all fall. I was speaking with Mono Gonzalez earlier today about where does America lie in Revelation or in the Ezekiel Wars, Ezekiel 38. Where is America? I think, among other different military applications, America will be neutralized. I don't think we'll be wiped off the face of the map. That's my opinion. That doesn't make it a fact. But I think we will be neutralized whenever Iran develops their nuclear weapon and is officially about to launch it towards Israel. Which may mean that the next president, if they are conservative, will then enact a certain special military mission called Nitro Zeus, which is, it is a military mission to use our special forces, multiple different army units, Air Force and Marine forces, to neutralize the fusion centers that are deep underground and to hit various different underground, extremely well protected targets. And when the Pentagon came up with this plan, Nitro Zeus, I actually know a guy who is involved in this. The accepted casualty rate was 85%. So the forces that we were going to fling into the jaws of death knew that 85% of them were going to die in the burning sands of Iran. And they knew also that they were going to come into engagement with Russia. So why is this important upon the national scale? Well, the nation states within the BRICS nations are all trying to go to the gold scale, all right, the gold currency. So Russia and China have been getting quite a bit of their gold from Iran and other resources, to include oil. So if we effectively try to take out the mullahs, start a revolution, start a civil war, and then most likely, I would say, Israel would attempt to help with that, then the whole world will be pointing fingers at America and Israel for trying to overthrow Iran the way we did Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Iraq. And that's when China and Russia will come to the aid. Operation Nitro Zeus will commence. It'll be a bloody mess. And maybe, just maybe, that's when the kings of the East say it's time to neutralize America. How could they do that? EMP? Possibly. Cyber attack, grid down, most likely. Nuclear attack upon Cheyenne Mountain, NORAD. Washington, D.C.? Possibly. They'd have to conflict with our fleets and our submarines. There's so many different ways where this could go wrong. I could continue to go forward with how many different ways this could go wrong. Yet, how many of our politicians have come out and said, these are the potential repercussions of the next 2 to 3 years of America if we don't combine ourselves as a nation again, if we don't put away this political biasness and work together, this is what we face. Any man who's ever been in war dreams of war, has nightmares of war. But I promise you, does not want to live in a state of war. Does not want to venture back into war. Many of us have joked about that, but none of us want to live through it again. None of us want our children to experience it. I don't want your children to experience it, or yourselves. But our politicians evidently do. And the next world war, I believe, will overshadow the horrors of World War I, will make you wish World War II was still a reality, because whatever falls down after World War III is the standing up of the New World Order. America will be taken down. We will not be the number one nation in the world again. It will be a conglomeration of nations. Now, I'm not saying this is end times. I'm saying it sure does seem like the infrastructure of the Antichrist is being constructed. And all this comes from war. And all a while all this is going on, I keep asking myself, what does it take for the man of peace to come on scene? What will it take? What war do we eventually have that will have the Antichrist reveal himself and call a ceasefire for the world?
That's what I'm leaving you with today. For everyone who is in Texas, today is Thursday, November 3rd. We have a very large supercell over Texas that's forming that should hit Friday. We are already expecting from Oklahoma City all the way to DFW to Southeast Texas and Northeast Texas into the Texarkana Range for there to be heavy tornadic activity. So prepare now for that. Go out, get your water, get some candles, get some lights, get some batteries. You know, do what you have to prepare for a possible very windy weekend. May God be with you all. May God protect you all. Stay vigilant. Stay frosty. The enemy goes around seeking whom he may devour. Be ready. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.